Hello, you're listening to the RTÉ Rugby Podcast. We're less than 24 hours away now from the opening ceremony tomorrow, Japan-Russia. That'll be live on RTÉ, and we'll be with you on the podcast twice a week between now and November 2nd. 9 a.m. for the final. Who knows? Anyway, we're going to go to Japan straight away because Paul O'Flynn is there, and I know he landed about 4 or 5 days ago, so he should be well acclimatised. First of all, Paul, tell me exactly where you are at this moment in time.
Exactly where I am at the moment is in Yokohama. We're in the centre of Yokohama, where the Irish team are based now, and it's where the game is on Sunday. So it's been nice to get into the city after the training camp of Chiba, and you can kind of start to see, a little bit of Rugby World Cup hype. It has to be said, it's not exactly capturing the imagination of the Japanese people. It's just such a vast country here, and rugby obviously is a tiny sport. So most people are going about their daily life and daily business without a care in the world for who's going to start at fullback for Ireland. But I think over the next couple of days, really from tomorrow on, we'll probably start to see the fans trickling into the city, and you know they will surely. Even if there's 40,000 or 50,000 of them, it's only a small dent here, but we'll surely see a few of them around. So the excitement is kind of building here amongst the rugby fraternity, at least.
And tell me, without quizzing you on your Leaving Cert geography, Yokohama, obviously one of the bigger cities in Japan, but what kind of scale is it?
Yeah, so it's hard to distinguish for someone like me who's just come in, really, what the difference is between Tokyo and Yokohama, because it just goes on and on and on. It's just one big, vast conurbation, to use a geography word from my Leaving Cert. But, Tokyo is 38 million people or so. Yokohama, then the small little sister below it down to the south, is 3.8 million. So, just about the population of Ireland. They're about squeezed into a city. So it's just massively dense. Really, there's people everywhere. And getting from kind of A to B can be a bit of a challenge, but it's hard, definitely, for me and all the rest of us here to figure out where Yokohama ends and where Tokyo starts.
Is access to the players very strictly marshalled, Irish players?
Yeah, I mean, this has been the case for a long time now, and it was never going to change really for the World Cup. So they were out in their training camp in Chiba. They arrived last Thursday, so they're here pretty much a week now, last Thursday evening. They went straight to Chiba, which is just, again, in Tokyo Bay, about an hour from Tokyo, but a quieter kind of a spot. And they were locked away, really, from the kind of hype and the hustle and bustle of the city, which I think is the way Joe Schmidt likes it. It's the way the management team like it. I'm not sure whether the players like it or not, but they didn't seem to grumble too much. So they were all there for the week. They were doing their training, their team meetings, their preparation, all that kind of stuff, and the sort of the relaxed idea. I mean, Joe was asked about this, and he said the thinking is, Japan is a bit of a whirlwind place. Maybe it was easier to get into a quieter place, get the players kind of over the jet lag, get them used to the surrounds of Japan before they really kind of hit the hustle and bustle of the city, which they came into yesterday now. So the players, because it's a Rugby World Cup, we get a little bit more access from a press conference point of view. A lot of players put up every single day. We get kind of four put up in front of you, top table press conference. So, that is better than we would get, say, at Carlton House normally during a Six Nations or something like that. But the actual kind of access to the team, like, for example, we didn't get pictures of them training on the pitch until Wednesday. So we're here for 5 days before anyone was allowed in to see a training session. We saw some gym sessions on Monday as well, but it's kind of 15 minutes at the start, and then the media are kicked out, and everything goes on from there. So you do see players knocking around the team hotel and things like that, but it's I suppose it's not really the done thing to go up and ask Robbie Henshaw, for example, how his hamstring is progressing.
Right, yeah, you might find yourself slightly unpopular. It's a strange one, because it's years since I kind of had intersection with the team, and I remember when they were in the Killiney Hotel, whatever that was, Killiney Castle or Killiney Court Hotel, and there did seem to be more of a kind of an intersection between players and media. But now it's very, very strictly corralled, from what I can gather, because I suppose what I'm trying to get at, no one really knows what's going on behind closed doors, do they? I mean, we have an approximation of it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. And really, all you can do as a reporter here is report what you're being told from the top table, aside from the few little bits and bobs of rumours that you get around the place. And, you know, that's just the reality of it. So we can only say Keith Earls and Rob Kearney put their boots on and walked out onto the pitch for training. We can say they warmed up. But after that, you know, everyone goes out. There's really high, 10-foot high security screens around the training. Where they trained was in the absolute middle of nowhere. It was beside a fire brigade academy. There was some kind of hilarious scenes at the start of training yesterday where smoke bombs were let off and there were sirens and for some reason an Aerosmith track playing out beside the players. So the players were a bit bemused by that. I think someone from the IRFU ran over very quickly to ask them to stop the smoke bombs because they were pretty pungent as the players were about to train. But it really, it's impossible unless you climbed to the top of the fire tower and had a long lens. You just wouldn't get to see the training. So that aspect of it, we only have the management's word for it on who's fit and who isn't.
The smoke bomb kind of stuff, access to Paul, the players, sorry, but was that not some sort of kind of attempt to create a high pressure environment? No.
No, it's not like putting baby oil on the ball or shampoo. If that wasn't clear, this is in the fire academy. They were doing some training.
I got
so
you,
the smoke bombs were put off and they kind of floated across. But no, it was. But yeah, the access, the players themselves are more than happy to chat when the press conference is finished. They'll stay around and spend 5 or 10 minutes. I think it's probably nice for them to see some other people, some maybe familiar faces from home, and just have a little chat about certain things. You know, that's kind of outside their camp bubble. So I don't think they have any issue really. It's just that they kind of, it's seen as one of the tasks they do on a given day. There's two or three players put up for the media. They sit at the top table, they answer their questions, and then they go back to their team room and back to whatever they were doing.
It's a necessary evil in many ways for them. I know that it's not that they have a profound dislike of the media, but there is a sense that, look, these guys are in a kind of some elite secret society at the moment, and the first we'll know how they are is when they take to the field.
Yeah, that's really it. I mean, I suppose tomorrow on team naming day you always get a better indication, because that's when there's no room for kind of manoeuvre anymore. The cloak and dagger stuff has to go away. You've got to name your team, and we find out for sure then who's fit and who isn't. But I mean, I think at this stage we're getting to the stage of what we can say is maybe a settled enough team. I don't think, reading between the lines, that Rob Kearney and Keith Earls are going to start. I may be wrong about that, but that would be my best guess. Robbie Henshaw is definitely ruled out. Apart from that, I think at this stage the team probably nearly picks itself, and I'm sure you'll chat about that a little bit more later on. But tomorrow, I think with the team naming, it's 7 o'clock Irish time tomorrow morning. I think we'll have a better sense then of kind of what's been going on for the past week here in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt, but this is purposeful, and we won't care if the World Cup goes well. Bernard Jackman's on the line, and Wes Liddy's here with me. Just, Wes, in terms of the 10-foot wall, high security wall, that's a good kind of image for the way that Joe controls things as well. And as I said, none of us will care if it goes well, but at the moment it's kind of all guesswork, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it can be put in stark contrast to when you hear about 15,000 fans turning up for training sessions for Wales and for New Zealand, things like that. Am I surprised by it? No. Aside from professional access, do I really care what way they approach it? No. It's one of those things, if you progress well, it'll have been a masterstroke to cocoon them and unleash them on the tournament. And if it doesn't, it'll be all these comparisons to the outskirts of Bordeaux in 2007 very quickly. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but there were fewer channels back in 2007, you know, and a leakier ship. It was funny. I mean, this is the most unleaky ship. And, you know, Ireland, we all like to gossip, and we all know friends of friends and a cousin who has a physio who visited Rob Kearney yesterday. And there's nothing coming out. Bernard, I mean, is this an absolute kind of Joe's first commandment, is that nothing should escape from the camp unless it's in the controlled circumstances of the daily press briefings?
Yeah, he tries to keep it very tight. Obviously, you know, it's no accident that there was 15,000 fans watching Wales train for the last 2.5 years. The Welsh Rugby Union have been sending out community officers to go into the schools and clubs and hospitals over there and actually start to prepare them for the visit to Wales, to try and make, you know, that city, you know, really Welsh friendly, but also commercially to sell Welsh kit and merchandise, etc. So they went after that approach. Ireland are very different. Ireland want to get in, do their business and get out. And I know you say that it's a leak-free zone, but that's because, you know, the competition hasn't started yet, and if things stay positive, I think, you know, that'll, and results are good, that'll hold. But I think the big problem in 2007 was performances were poor, and you know, the level of criticism and interest in actually what was happening in camp heightened, and you know, from that then obviously, you know, there started to be false rumours, actually, which turned out to be the case. But
plenty of them.
It created, it was nonsense. But hopefully, you know, results are and performances are really good, and we have none of that nonsense, and everyone, you know, can concentrate on the positive elements of Irish rugby. But Joe definitely likes to keep it quiet. I know that he worries a lot about team selections and leaks in teams and giving opposition coaches an extra couple of days. And, you know, there's a team going around WhatsApp at the moment, which would lead you to believe that Keith Earls and Rob Kearney are actually out of this game. But yet they were, you know, they were presented a training yesterday for the first 15 minutes when the media had access. So all kinds of cloak and dagger stuff. But, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the team tomorrow. And hopefully, you know, those two injuries in particular have cleared up. And, you know, we can have Keith Earls and Rob Kearney for the Scotland game, because without them, it's a different challenge.
Yeah, just to finish up on that, and maybe it's becoming too much of a pet subject for me this early in the podcast, but I you don't get that kind of sense of confidentiality from a group of people, a group of younger men in particular, unless there's a strong fear factor. I'm not saying that the reason that they obey everything Joe says is fear. It's not, because he's made them better players and the success has followed and all the rest of it. But there is an element that the Joe that we never see publicly is a scary beast.
Yeah, he is, but I think, you know, it's not just fear of him. It's how he sells the importance of a tight ship and a unified approach. You know, from 1 to 31, and then obviously the 18 or 19 or 20 backroom staff that effectively you've got to put the collective above the individual. And I think I think it's not just the fear of Joe. It's actually, okay, this is going to help us achieve our dreams, and players have bought into that just as much. But the problem is, you know, it's just a level of layers behind every player. So you have family, agents, friends, etc. So things can get out, and there's no malice often behind it. It's just literally informing someone close to you, you know, that you're not in the team, and from that then selection gets out. So it's a very difficult thing to control, but you know, definitely it's something that Joe Schmidt puts a high value on.
Yeah, of course. We're
I think, Darragh, just to
go up, Paul,
just to add to that, really, from what Bernie was saying, like, Joe was out earlier in the week, I think last Monday, he spoke to the press, and I think you could tell he was definitely kind of tense and maybe you'd say a little bit nervous even, and well, he might be, you know, it's a huge week in the build up to one of the biggest games of his time as Ireland manager, and there's so much riding on the next few weeks. But as the week went on and more players kind of came through and we got to see them, I think the players themselves seem to be very, very relaxed. And like Johnny Sexton was talking about, that they've had their kind of their fun and games at home, and this week was just all about work. They need to get their message right. They need to do everything. And if you have Joe setting that message, if you have Johnny setting that message as well, I think you can see why all the younger players may fall into line like that. And I think, you know, as Bernard said, with things going well at the moment and everyone kind of vying for places and everything up for grabs, then there's no reason why they wouldn't all be on message and all be, you know, willing to work towards the same goal.
Absolutely, fair enough. I mean, Wes, it wouldn't be so much of an issue, apart from some of the recent performances, the competitive performances we've seen from the Six Nations from Ireland, just gave the impression that they weren't completely firing on all cylinders mentally or physically, I suppose. So what we're waiting for is to see if that clicks. And you do, as a person, you don't need to be an expert. If you watch enough sport, you just know 15 minutes in, hang on, they're there. And that's what we're all dying to find out.
Yeah, I suppose we're all hoping that there's a, I suppose, a bit of a eureka on Sunday morning. That
a bit of one, yeah.
That the last 9 months are, you know, a blip. I don't know. I know their preparation has obviously been calibrated in a very detailed way. Like, even the way Paul mentioned that Johnny had said that this week was all about work. I mean, typically, I think a lot of teams would arrive with the work done and kind of use the first few days for public engagement and settling into the surroundings and stuff. So there's maybe a sense, and some people I've talked to, that the team are, you know, hoping to hit an absolute peak a little later in the tournament rather than the first game, which is obviously a risk, but possibly a necessary one if making it past that quarterfinal glass ceiling is your ultimate goal. But I don't know. It's the more I think about it, you know, I do have worries, I suppose, even as a fan, that I don't know if you can just flick a switch. I'm hoping you can, but I think there's certainly doubt, but it's probably tempered public expectation, obviously, which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
No, I think it's a good thing.
But, I mean, from our point of view, as people that are working on the tournament, I suppose, it sounds terrible to say it, but it almost becomes irrelevant as this tournament starts to pick up steam, because if you're just tuning in for a match here and there, you're almost following Ireland more, whereas I think the overall tournament starts to throw up subplots and little quirky stories and trends and all the rest of it, and like it just takes on a momentum of its own anyway. So, you know, we are Ireland focused, but I mean, the Ireland story will kind of go out of your head for a few hours on Saturday when New Zealand and South Africa are locking horns. So, there's stories and interesting debate points right across the board, you know.
Yeah, it's just like conditioning is a catch-all word for it, but we know it's going to be the most attritional 7 weeks there ever has been, because like it's the nature of sport. It's 4 years on from the last one. 2015 was unrecognizable in terms of body shape, body mass, power, gym performance to 1987. This will have taken a step forward again. So I suppose when you see the people run out in the pitch in the Irish shirt, you want to see them looking as good as they ever did. Now, we saw a glimpse, I think, Carney and Sexton, notwithstanding Carney's subsequent injury, they looked absolutely
fantastic.
I think
a lot of them looked in very good shape.
They did.
In the warm-ups. It didn't necessarily manifest in performance.
Yeah.
But I think physically they looked in good shape. Birch will know a lot more about this than me, but
yeah,
I think... You know, we're hearing Joe has openly said that he expects 6-7 minutes more ball and play time, which, you know, at the last World Cup...
That's 25%, by the way.
Yeah, and at the last World Cup, I suppose, in hindsight, New Zealand drove a trend where, you know, players typically across the board dropped a couple of kilos in a search for more mobility and better endurance on the basis of that ball and play time. But I suppose we're hearing that that's expected to grow again, but equally we've seen with our own eyes a huge swing back towards, you know, collision-based, power-based rugby through England and South Africa's success in recent months. So I suppose it's interesting that there's an expectation of a leap forward on both of those fronts.
Yeah.
And you're kind of always wondering when we reach this ceiling of conditioning, or not that people can't become more and more conditioned, but that... You know, I don't want to go on to the negative and the eve of the tournament, but you do start to wonder that the game starts to eat itself a little bit as the attrition just continues to rise and rise and rise.
Absolutely, and I think if we widen it out to the game in general, that's a good discussion to have. But just looking at Ireland, and I'm going to get Birch in a second, but like Paul, you're the body of the sports department here in RTE, given all your swimming activities. In fairness, you're a very fit man yourself. I mean, what's your judgment, just using your eyes, on this whole tapering process that they're producing? The athletes ready for the right occasion. Do they physically look absolutely primed to you now?
Yeah, I mean, genuinely, yes. Like, we see these players over time, you know, and throughout the season and stuff, and, you know, you can see sinews and kind of veins and things like that, if that's what we're talking about here. You know, they're really, really fit, and I think there's no doubt about that. Why wouldn't they be? You know, you know they've basically been in camp for 3 months now, since early June, I think they gathered. So it's hard for them not to be, but I think everyone knows it's much easier when you have a goal in sight that you'll skip those couple of beers, you'll skip that bar of chocolate, you know, you'll do those extra few press-ups or sit-ups or chin-ups, you know. I guess like that's all part of it. But one of the things that did come up just on that, we spoke one of the days to Kieran Ruddock, who's the assistant strength and conditioning coach. He's Reese's brother. And I asked him about the fact that they've had these couple of soft tissue injuries, Robbie Henshaw's hamstring strain and Rob Kearney's calf, and obviously Keith Earls getting the knock before, and if it was something they were worried about, and you know, he obviously dismissed that, you know, and said they're very confident in what they've been doing. But I think that would be something that would be a little bit concerning, just in the fact that if someone goes down with a knock that they get in training, that's fine, but at this stage, before they've played any games, when they're just training, should players really be getting those kind of injuries? series. So I suppose the proof will be in the pudding, but they definitely look physically fit, yeah.
It's interesting when Paul actually, obviously we know it, but you don't put it in context, but when someone says 3 months, it's a hugely extended build-up. And I suppose even that whole idea of being locked away in Chiba a little bit, like, I mean, I presume there's a massive kind of, you can't maintain that kind of sense of heightened alertness all the time. There has to be down times and all the rest of it, obviously, but it is kind of it's over now, so it'll start to fade into the background, but it is a fascinating process how elite teams manage long-term preparation, not just physically, but physically, mentally, in terms of keeping people engaged, keeping squad harmony, and probably ultimately the team that does that best wins this World Cup.
I don't know, is it that? I mean, you know.
It is.
If Russia do it, like, they're not going to win the World Cup.
They won't, as being amateurs for a start.
Okay,
so,
but if Japan do it, even if they maximise the conditioning and the mood in the camp and they taper the.
Yeah, but I think if you've evenly matched teams like England and New Zealand, let's say.
Okay, fair enough.
The team that gets their preparation. Yeah. Adjusted better,
but the point
will perform better.
Like if I
think as well, it's worth mentioning. Just Wes, as you say, locked away in Chiba. I mean, the players have had a couple of down days here. It's only about an hour from Tokyo, and I know a good group of them went in to Tokyo and had a kind of a day around the city, and it's an amazing place to spend a day. Some of them went to see sumo. The wrestling championships are on here at the moment. Really big things. So some of them went to see that. I mean, speaking to CJ Stander, he said he just hung around near the hotel. They went to kind of an amusement arcade and he went for dinner and stuff, so you know it's horses for courses. Like, yeah, 3 months is a really long time, but within that they have had time at home with their families, they have had, you know, team bonding sessions, group things away, they've been, you know, back here and there. And I often think, sometimes we talk about this a lot, it is elite sport, it is mental, but they're young guys, they're getting paid a lot of money to keep fit, to train and to, you know, play rugby. So they are living the dream, you know, for all we say they're locked away, I get their preparation right, you know. So I think we could overemphasize it.
That, oh, listen, that we're not,
Ireland
it's not
are
like,
kind of locked away and other teams are having the crack, you know.
No, we weren't saying that, you know? But it is just a long period of time to manage, I guess.
It's not like a dog's trust shelter now or anything, like, we're not saying that. But I do think that this conditioning thing, we expect the best conditioned Irish team ever for a number of reasons. The natural evolution of sport, the fact that the ball and play time has increased 20-25%, and the fact that the monsters who are going to win this tournament are going to be probably England, South Africa or New Zealand. And that their conditioning and physicality is just at another plane altogether. So we could produce, Bernard, the best conditioned Irish team ever, but they could look puny next to what the All Blacks, England and South Africa do.
Yeah, I don't think they will, though. I think it's an important point to make, as in why teams look physically better now than they did a year ago. It's only every 4 years that you get your best players in your country together for 3 months, and everything is geared towards peaking, you know, at the end of that block of 12 or 13 weeks. So a normal pre-season for Johnny Sexton, he'll have gone on a June summer tour. He'll come back in that, you know, mid to late June. He'll have 4 or 5 weeks off. So effectively, he's only starting his pre-season on the 1st of August. So he gets about, even in Ireland where they get 6 or 7 weeks pre-season, the delayed start, they're only getting 6 or 7 weeks. So, you know, all of us who are looking from the outside and going, wow, these boys are, you know, they're at a different level in terms of how good they look and how powerful they are and how lean they are. That's because they've had a block that you only get once every 4 years to actually really develop. Because as soon as you start playing games and bringing contact into your training, your ability to increase your speed, your power, etc., drops off massively. So that's the gamble Ireland have made. You know, England and Wales seem to have decided to sacrifice a little bit of that potential growth and potential power advantages to be ready to play warm-up games in August, early August, which is obviously their back-to-back games, which are obviously very intense. So that means they probably started 3 or 4 weeks before Ireland. So, you know, I think what Johnny Sexton is talking about is that Ireland left that late. You know, they obviously got shocked a little bit by England, but that's understandable. They started to build it up for the Welsh game and look really good, the Welsh home game. And now it's actually all that detail and all that those systems that they need to build in over the course of these 2 weeks leading into Scotland, and then still having a little bit left physically. So, yeah, but I think Ireland with our best 15, you know, we're not a million miles in terms of athleticism behind the rest. England obviously looked to be incredibly powerful, South Africa as well. But, you know, I like to think that through technique and good structure, we can hopefully overcome that potential power deficit.
Right. I mean, but so boxing analogy, it's been a lot of skipping and little sparring so far.
Yeah, from a rugby point of view, yes. But yeah, the heavy duty stuff, I think happened post England. But you know, there's still elements of that I think will come to the fore. So, for example, that last 7 minutes against Wales, you know, when you're on their line, you know, I'd be shocked if Ireland don't improve in that area and we become much more efficient in terms of turning that into 5 or 7 points.
Okay. Wes, is Scotland first up the ideal match if you are kind of trying to arrowhead your way towards the power flourishing later in the tournament? Because one thing you would think that you can get away with slightly against Scotland isn't the skills, a skills deficit, but maybe there isn't that power deficit.
Yeah, maybe. I was looking at a lot of the New Zealand media during the week, and I saw an article there in on stuff.co.nz actually.
But yes, good site actually.
They had a bunch of data scientists brought in to conduct an experiment where they basically came up with, you know, statistics which very clearly proved over the course of all the World Cups that the teams that have had their primary game against their biggest competitors in their own pool early have generally flourished, and the teams that have been left to play other contenders towards the end of the pool stages have not. And I suppose, look, it makes sense.
Twin peaks.
Yeah, England are playing France and Argentina in their last two pool games, and obviously they run a risk that by the time you get to, say, a semi-final, you're totally out of steam. So I suppose, in a way, it's a sensible strategy that, you know, maybe we're at 95% against Scotland. If that means being absolutely at 100% come a quarter final when you will absolutely need to be at 100%. But I suppose it's obviously there's huge risk involved because there's not that much between the teams. If we're any bit off, there's less between the teams. And equally, you know, I don't think you can coast for the other three games in the pool either. And you know, kind of almost go back to a state of rustiness. You know, you'd imagine a full-strength team has to play against Samoa, regardless of being true, just to be at full tilt for the quarterfinal to come. So if you're at full strength first and last, and probably out of necessity against Japan as well, this kind of opportunity for rotation, you know, it's not quite as big as people like to think it is, I think.
Well, it's less controllable depending on results because everything is stepped forward. I mean, a win against Scotland and all of a sudden a new vista opens up for Joe in terms of conditioning and preparing and sheltering and bench.
Do you know what? I'd be honest and not to like dampen the hype or anything, and it's the same with New Zealand, South Africa. Other than confidence, does it matter if we come one or two who we play in the quarterfinal? You know, I mean, it's like picking between apples and oranges there, whether you want the All Blacks or South Africa in the quarterfinals.
I accept that, but by coming second, it would suggest that we probably lose a match, and the more likely one to lose would be against Scotland. So all of a sudden, you have an absolute pressure cooker against the host nation.
Yeah, for sure.
And you can't rest.
And there's momentum within the tournament and all the rest. But equally, I mean, if New Zealand are beaten by the Springboks on Saturday, are they throwing the towel at the tournament? Of course not.
No.
You know, so, I mean, It's to keep that kind of tempered approach throughout and looking at the long-term goal all the time.
Yeah, we saw it. Was it 2007 that England got caned by South Africa in the pool?
Yeah, no, that was probably a bizarre set of circumstances that poor side ended up going on to a final and nearly winning it, yeah. I suppose. They just got...
Phantom tribe.
But it happens within tournaments. Teams build momentum, things start to go for them, kind of unexplainably almost at times.
Yeah.
But I think the Scots are kind of... They've been very quiet until this week.
This Taylor is a good player, isn't he?
Yeah, and Thompson at number 8. And, like, they're starting to... They look decent, you know, and... You know, with the conditions over there, and if Ireland are that little bit off it, it could become a very, very, very difficult game. I wouldn't be at all putting the mortgage on an Ireland win.
Well, look, that's another way of saying we haven't a clue, and we work in it, and you watch it more than I do, and you know way more about rugby than I do, but you still haven't a clue what's going to happen. I mean, there is very little security in any analysis that I've read. Everybody's kind of, you can more or less say anything about this game.
Yeah, well, I mean, anything where you're starting off, you're basing your judgments on the evidence you've seen.
Yeah.
And the evidence we've seen is negative,
sure,
in Ireland's sense. So yes, now we're suspending evidence to look at evidence from 2 years ago. So, yeah, there is absolutely an element of uncertainty.
And some kind of faith in Joe stuff as well, which don't tell me it's not.
Yeah, and do you know what? Maybe it's a bit of bias in me coming out, but I do think Joe will get this tapering right. He will have things in you know, plans that are as yet unhatched. And I do expect us to perform, but there is a nagging fear that maybe...
Yeah.
Things have just left us behind a little bit over the last 12 months or so.
Bernard?
Yeah, I know that Wesley is basing that kind of apprehension on what he's seen, but I would be more optimistic, and I think that I think we saw enough against Wales to see that bit of bite back in the contact zone, and I think Ireland are in a really good place, and I think that some of that's based around trust of the management, but also, you know, having spoken to some of the players in camp, you generally have a really good feel for where you're at, and they really feel well prepped. They've already kind of they had already worked on what the game plan was likely to be against Scotland and Japan.
This is interesting. Now keep going on this, because this is getting behind the tape.
Yeah, they basically listen. If a coach, so Warren Gatland, for example, you know, he doesn't show things that he's not going to use, or keep things up his sleeve for round four of the group stages. He likes to have a very simple type of game plan, get his players really fit, and go out there and implement that, and have real certainty around what we're doing. Whereas Joe is a different type of coach, and a lot of Ireland's success in under Joe's tutelage, and also Leinster's success, was built around elements of trick plays, or really targeting an identified weakness in the opposition, or taking away one of their strengths. And so he probably is the coach in world rugby who is willing to vary his game plan more on a week-to-week basis than anybody else. So when you have a coach who's that's his mantra, and when that's been successful for the players, when you go into friendly games, and also in the Six Nations, there wasn't that level of planning.
He nearly said as much, didn't he? You know, without
yeah,
saying
there
it
was,
explicitly.
And like, and honestly, yeah. I think that's, there was also a little bit more freedom in terms of what guys were allowed to do. Now, it didn't look like that to the naked eye, that Ireland were, you know, playing barbarian style rugby. But when you go away from, you know, having one way of doing something, and that clarity around that, the guys can actually kind of play what they see. If everyone's on the same page, it's a complete, you know, there's a bit huge drop off, particularly for an Irish team who are used to, you know, that controlled, I suppose, micromanaging of every part of the game. So that's back now, and I think that being back will give the players confidence. That will give us certainty, and based on that, I think, you know, we'll turn around what has been a disappointing 9 months. But there's reasons for it, and if you understand those reasons, you know, it leads to giving you a little bit more optimism. But and I do believe that this team are ready to go and perform at a level we haven't seen for 9 months.
Great, and that's Sunday. Yeah, I mean, it's just fantastic. But look, I mean, knowing Joe and his MO, how important is the fact that this game has been in the calendar for, what is it, 18 months, that it can be, insofar as any future event can be, analysed to within an inch of its life, you know, 18 months out, which is a century in professional sport?
Yeah, I think it's obviously huge. I think, you know, psychologically, you know, beating Scotland the last couple of times is really important. I think we've managed to bully them a little bit physically, and I also think that the way we will play the game on Sunday will, you know, I talked about taking away team strengths. I mean, you know, Scotland's strengths are when the game opens up, and how we traditionally play the game is we don't let it open up. You know, there's very little turnover ball, there's very little loose kicking, and that's how they, you know, they're set up to play. And it's Gregor Townsend's, it's in his DNA. He did it with Scotland. He did it as a player. They're very good in unstructured situations. But again, I think our strength and our core way of playing is probably the worst type of game plan that Scotland could come up against. So yeah, I think we're well suited to this game. And yeah, for sure, you know, lots of homework's been done and prep's been done. And now it's just a case of making it happen on Sunday with a high level of accuracy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, Wes, a lot of it is down to, you know, it's never going to be boring. It's a World Cup. It's going to be 80 minutes. But, I mean, if it's just pretty error-free, basic, strong possession rugby, it looks like that we have the game to beat Scotland.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think, you know, what do you go to down to an under-12s match or to a World Cup? I mean, if your set-piece functions well, your defence is good, you're organised, you're motivated, you know, that wins you 80% of games. Obviously, Ireland have had a little more than that over time, but I suppose the question people always had was, did we need to add another layer, particularly in an attacking context, to challenge for ultimate honours, like winning a tournament? Whether we have that added, we don't know. But yeah, the 80% probably gets us over the line against Scotland if we just get back to what we were doing even.
What alarm bells about Scotland would you have, Bernard?
Yeah, I think just their individuals, if the game breaks up, and like that would come from, a wild missed pass, an offload in contact that, you know, doesn't go to hand, and that's where they spring into life, and they are quite dangerous in that. You know, we saw the second half against England when, you know, it looked like a lost cause and England switched off a little bit and got a little bit loose. You know, some of the rugby they played was phenomenal, but I genuinely, obviously we got to fear them and respect them because, you know, it's first game up and I'm basing my optimism on the belief in the players and coaches to be ready. But if we play to the level that I think we will, I don't see them really having the threats to beat us. So, you know, that's a good place to be. Obviously, if we don't perform, we're obviously very vulnerable, and that's the case in any team. But I don't see Scotland's game being anything that we should overly worry about.
Yeah, it's a quarterfinal playoff. I mean, but at the same time, the problem I would have, which is completely unscientific, is that every year for the last 5 years, people have said this could be Scotland's year, and it's turned out not to be. And everybody's saying this year, Erna, Scotland having to hope. But yeah, that's Pishogue stuff. What about the All Blacks team? Let's talk a bit about other stuff. The All Blacks team named this morning. I'm looking forward to seeing Rhys, 3 caps, and just on YouTube, he looks pretty hot.
Could have been a Connacht player. Yeah, they're interesting. They've changed quite fundamentally now from the kind of established players, Rhys and George Bridge, obviously, and they're on the wing. You know, Ben Smith out of the side, one of the all-time greats at this stage. Not a lot of certainty around the midfield. I think they've done the right thing going back to Leonard Brown. The Bowden Barrett one is obvious, but it's probably the most compelling storyline going into the opening games. There seems to be a school of thought that Hansen thinks having 2 playmakers on the field is the way to get around what defensive approaches have been thrown at the All Blacks in particular.
But 2 playmakers at 10 and 15 is a twist on that. Usually it's 10 and 12, isn't it?
Yeah, and they've been to the forefront of having that, and I think they've been building towards it. Ideally, they probably wanted Damien McKenzie there to do it before he got injured, but it's still a strange one. You know, Barrett's probably the best rugby player in the world. He mightn't be the best out half in the world, but he's the best rugby player. Mm. And you're still taking a guy who's been absolutely central to everything you've done for a number of years now, who's a key decision maker, contributor, kind of playmaker, and you're ensuring, no matter what you say about dual playmakers or not, you're ensuring he's getting less access to decision making and less touches on the ball. And if it was Johnny Sexton or Owen Farrell was the guy coming in at 10, I could see it more. Mm. But the drop-off from Barrett to Mwanga is still fairly significant. So I thought when he was doing it during the Rugby Championship, it was an attempt to, you know, develop depth, give Mwanga time in the jersey. Maybe I'm completely out of the loop, but I never really thought he'd go with it as his first choice 15.
But is it just for the South African challenge in particular? We don't know, but I mean, one would think that it has to be, that he has to, he has a slightly more conservative.
I don't think it's necessarily more conservative, to be honest.
Do you think Barrett at 15 is giving him some sort of security? I know Barrett is an absolute strike runner, but like at the same time...
No, I think you'd be going with Ben Smith if it was security at 15. You were looking for, you'd be going with that experience of Ben Smith. And I suppose the changes he's made, like some people were complaining that maybe they stuck with the established players too much through the World Cup cycle, that maybe the time for change was a few years back, but... These new players that have now found themselves in the team has to a point been the product of accident. It wasn't like there was a grand plan to have George Bridge and Sivu Reese as your starting wings that's been hatched over years. Now, you have to allow for form, and the guys have been prolific in Super Rugby, but
I don't know.
Their planning doesn't seem to have been maybe quite where you'd expect it to be, but... Equally, they're the one team that can turn up and just make fools of all of that talk, you know?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. If you look at 2004 and 2005, they were just unbeatable. And then 2007 rocked along and it didn't happen. So I presume they're hoping for that in reverse this time.
Yeah, but I mean, even... I always think the narrative around them choking at World Cups that used to exist was garbage, to be honest. Like, yeah. I mean, the last... Richie McCaw, Dan Carter's replacement, you know, that in that France game in the quarterfinal, everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Yeah.
And you bring a little bit of luck on yourself, but you would be looking at guys like Nipo Laulala in the front row and kind of going, not too sure about that in the biggest games against the strongest packs. Brodie Retallick maybe being out. There's a lot of conjecture back and forth with the Springbok camp about that. Obviously, massive whether he plays or not. You know, Ardie Savea, someone the management never really had faith in as a starter. Now, probably again through necessity, they've ended up with him at six. And he's playing really well. I just think when you look at the established core they had in 2015, which was probably the best side we've ever seen. But, you know, Sam Kane isn't Richie McCaw. You know, Savea isn't Kaino. Ryan Crotty isn't Ma Nanu. Richie Mwanga isn't Dan Carter. You know, I don't think they're quite as good a team as they have been. That might be still good enough to win the World Cup, but I don't think they're where they were a few years ago.
Sure. Well, you're saying the 2015 team would win this World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, if they were conditioned like the teams in this World Cup will be, there's more individual talent in that 2015 team, and they had longer together to foster that culture that they're so proud of and. You know, experience
what
and all
again,
the rest
better,
of it.
Better
people make better All Blacks, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they do get more than their fair share of scrutiny as well, being the All Blacks. That's but I suppose the whole thing is under scrutiny. How do you see that one? I mean, that's just fantastic. That's just Saturday, isn't it? That's Saturday looked after Bernard, isn't it?
Yeah, it should be a great game. I think, you know, if the South Africans beat this All Blacks team, you know, the level of scrutiny and pressure on the All Blacks will grow. I agree with Wesley. I think, you know, there's all like it doesn't look like fairness. It is great that they're picking fellas on form, the likes of Bridge and Reese. But you know, most other teams are looking to build, you know, their starting team 2 years out, and it is a little bit risky from that point of view. Shannon Frizzell. You know, he's come from nowhere. I actually tried to sign him for the Dragons. He's Welsh qualified, but he got a contract the last minute to go to Highlanders, and he's come through. Very talented young kid. But again, you know, when you're comparing him to the likes of the experience and quality they had back in the day, and I think this team selection shows a little bit how the All Blacks have been left a little bit light. You know, obviously they're producing. Wonderful talent, but there has been a big player drain towards Japan and Europe over the last 3 or 4 years, and I'm sure Hansen and his coaches, you know, can feel that a little bit when they're putting this selection in. Obviously, all as Wesley said, all very good rugby players, but I'm not sure about you know, Casey Luala's brother Nipo as a dominant tight head scrummager. He's a very good rugby player, but he has a lot to prove at the highest level, so definitely doubt question marks and doubts around the All Blacks going into this competition.
Well, certainly. I mean, if you want to start at the front row, that is some test, isn't it? First match, that'll tell us quite a lot, or it'll tell them quite a lot about themselves, because I presume South Africa have only two speeds, which is asleep and vicious. You know, they're not going to taper into this tournament against New Zealand. I would imagine that, I don't know, this is a hunch that to South Africa, this would be a statement that they would probably be very anxious to make, whereas I take Wes's point that if it's a good game and it runs away from New Zealand, they probably won't lose as much sleep over it.
No, they won't, but I do think that whoever wins it is gaining a big psychological advantage.
And more pressure?
Yeah, more pressure potentially, but you know, whoever South Africa and All Blacks, if they're in the knockout stages, are going to be, you know, the two forerunners, given what's happened in the Rugby Championship and given their history in this competition. So I think pressure, they're used to pressure, and they'll be able to handle that. I'd much prefer to be in a group who have, you know, had the knack of winning those big games, and so I think the stakes are pretty high. Obviously, you know, the quarterfinal isn't you know, the soft draw is probably isn't that relevant, but it's more around, you know, getting one over on another World Cup contender.
Yeah, and my favourite quote so far, 24 hours out, is Steve Hansen earlier in the week saying, pressure, we live there all the time, which is, you know, because we're always looking for new quotes on pressure, and we're all very bored with the Pressure Is For Tyres one, which is about a decade old. And now, less than a decade old, is the Rob Howley. What's any news today? I didn't see anything particularly breaking about that. I'm inclined to let due process run its course here, because, I mean, some of the rumours going around to me are a bit crazy. Any facts coming out about this?
No, I haven't heard anything. I mean, aside from what happens to him or what actually did happen, I mean, what interests me the most at this point is just, I mean, surely it's a massive, almost a death knell to Wales' chances in a sense. I mean, surely it's a huge upheaval. You know, Warren Gatland wouldn't be known as necessarily the most hands-on guy on the training ground. I mean, Bernard knows all these guys from his time in Wales, so...
What'll they miss by not having Rob Howley there?
Listen, I think it's a big blow to them. You know, for me, he's been head coach when Warren's been on lines tours duty. He's their attacking coach, he's their backs coach. He would take a lot of the review previews, have a good relationship with the players, well respected. The only thing I would say, you know, that might help Wales survive this is the fact that their attacking game isn't probably the most complicated. So, you know, from Stephen Jones' point of view, to go in there, he would know it pretty well. It wouldn't be his philosophy of how to play the game in terms of what we see at Scarlets, but it's a pretty simple system. It's a 1-3-3-1 system. And, you know, probably the fact of what happened to Anscombe and the injury doubts around, you know, Patchell with Bigger is probably not going to, you know, open up too much. So I'd say the Welsh attacking coach wasn't going to have the biggest influence on how they did in the tournament. It's going to come down to, you know, to the defensive side of the game, Sean Edwards in their kicking game with Neil Jenkins. But yeah, it's definitely a blow. He's a trusted lieutenant of Gatland. They've been together, you know, since he played under him in Wasps, and you know,
does it provide an excuse for people at the back of their minds for underperforming?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but listen, I think players are like Wales would want to perform at this World Cup, and I think excuses will be at the back of their mind. I think that's why, you know, it's really important that they have experienced coaches, you know, alongside Warren. Now, you know, with obviously, as I said, Neil Jenkins, Sean Edwards, and Robin McBride. So, you know, they can really make sure that the players are cushioned from this to a certain extent, and it doesn't become something that they can use as an excuse. In actual fact, they'll probably try and rally, you know, rally the troops and use it as a bit of a chip on their shoulder and a reason to go out and do it for Rob, because he is immensely popular. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out for Wales. I think they were in a good place going there, but obviously, it's a big shock to everybody involved how it's happened and so close to the tournament, etc. But I think they have probably enough experience to get over it, and because their game was more defensive and kicking game weighted, It might not be the blow to them that it might be to other teams.
Yeah, and we can discuss the ethics, if there is an ethical discussion, when we have the facts and not before. Give me one player each, guys, before we go, that you... I remember proudly picking Keith Earls as my mark for 2011's Irish player of the tournament. And actually, between himself and Ferris, it was close enough, and there was good performances. Who are you picking this time around as Ireland's man, Birch?
Yeah, I think Bundy Aki is the player I'm most looking forward to seeing at the World Cup. I think, you know, in all the performances in August, he has looked in the best possible physical shape, and he's been pretty devastating. We know when he's on form, you know, how effective he is for Connacht, and I think this is a world stage for him, and I think he could be a key man for us in this World Cup.
Okay, Bundy, a key for you. What about you, Az?
I think guys who seem to be coming to the boil nicely, that things are falling into place for... James Ryan and Josh Van der Fleer would be two for me.
Okay.
The big concerns, I suppose, with Van der Fleer, he's never too far from a knock the way he plays. Yeah, I think those two could be... Ryan could really leave as a star of the tournament if things go well, I think.
Yeah, I suppose I'm spoiled by him. I just expect it from him, but Van der Fleer to join in at the tournament of his life.
He looked really... Like, his pace in the wide channels, particularly in the last warm-up game, was really eye-catching, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe we forgot a little bit about just how good a player he was because we hadn't seen him for a while.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll stick with Stockdale. I mean, I just think he can do it, and we're going to need somebody who can score against... Top tier one nations, and I think also Andrew Conway is just... my heart is saying that I want a big one from him, and I think he will deliver and not let us down. Whether or not he gets to start at 15 is looking more likely now, isn't it, as we speak?
Yeah, I'd be more comfortable with Addison at 15 and him at 14.
Where is Addison physically at the moment?
In Ulster somewhere, I guess, getting ready for the Pro 14.
Okay, well, we'll keep a little Google tracker on him for you, Grant. All right, well, that's all we have today. Thanks very much to Paul O'Flynn, who's going to join us all through this run of the podcast. We let Paul go because he's on all sorts of duty, online, radio, telly, etc. out there. Bernard, who you'll see on the Highlights programme. Wes, you're producing the Highlights programme, so that should be good with you. And Claire McNamara leading that one. And we're on tomorrow morning. Yeah, if you're listening to this on Thursday, we're on 10 o'clock tomorrow for the 11:45 kickoff. And the reason there's a big lead into that is because we have the opening ceremony for you. Then it's Japan-Russia, and of course we're back on Sunday.
And a preview tonight.
Previews tonight. What time is your preview tonight?
9 o'clock with Bernard, Eddie and Fiona Coughlin, and some stuff from Paul, from Don Lennon, from Hugh in Japan, just getting ready for the big kickoff.
So it's against the head, but we won't call it against the head because it's World Cup against the head.
Call it what you like.
It's going to be good. Yeah. Brilliant. All right. And we'll be here twice a week throughout the Rugby World Cup. Find us on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever it is that you listen to your podcasts. And just again, let me remind you, all Ireland's games and the entire knockout phase of this tournament, you can watch on RTE2. And you can keep up to date online. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you Monday. We'll